198. All these moralities that direct themselves at the individual person for the sake of his happiness, as people say, what are they except proposals about conduct in relation to the degree of danger in which the individual person lives with himself? Recipes against his passions, his good and bad inclinations, to the extent that they have a will to power and would like to play the master. Small and great clever sayings and affectations, afflicted with the musty enclosed smell of ancient household remedies or old women's wisdom, all baroque and unreasonable in form, because they direct themselves to all, because they generalize where we should not generalize, all speaking absolutely, taking themselves absolutely, all spiced with more than one grain of salt, and much more bearable, sometimes even seductive, only when they learn to smell over-seasoned and dangerous, above all, about the other world. By any intellectual standard, all that is worth little and still a far cry from science, to say nothing of wisdom, but to say it again and to say it three times, prudence, 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 mixed in with stupidity, stupidity, stupidity. Whether it is now that indifference and coldness of a metaphorical statute against the hot-headed foolishness of the emotions which the Stoics recommended and applied as a cure, or even that no more laughing and no more crying of Spinoza, his excessively naive support for the destruction of the emotions through analysis and vivisection, or that repression of the emotions to a harmless mean, according to which they should be satisfied, the Aristotelianism of morality, even morality as the enjoyment of emotions in a deliberate dilution and spiritualization through artistic symbolism, something like music or the love of God and of man for God's sake, for in religion the passions have civil rights once more, provided that... And finally, even that accommodating and wanton dedication to the emotions, as Hafiz and Goethe taught, that daring permission to let go of the reins, that physical, spiritual licentia morum, freedom in behaviour, in the exceptional examples of wise old owls and drunkards, for whom it has little danger any more, this also for the chapter Morality as Timidity. 199. Given that at all times, so long as there have been human beings, there have also been herds of human beings, racial groups, communities, tribes, peoples, states, churches, and always a great many followers in relation to the small number of those issuing orders, and taking into consideration also that so far nothing has been better and longer practiced and cultivated among human beings than obedience, we can reasonably assume that typically now the need for obedience is inborn in each individual, as a sort of formal conscience which states, you are to do something or other without conditions, and leave aside something else without conditions. In short, thou shalt. This need seeks to satisfy itself and to fill its form with some content. Depending on its strength, impatience, and tension, it seizes on something without being very particular, like a coarse appetite, and accepts what someone or other issuing commands shouts in people's ears, parents, teachers, laws, class biases, public opinion. The curiously limited intelligence of human development, the way it hesitates, takes so long, often regresses and turns around on itself, is based on the fact that the herd instinct of obedience is passed on best and at the expense of the art of commanding. If we imagine this instinct at some point striding right to its ultimate excess, then there would finally be a total lack of commanders and independent people, or they would suffer inside from a bad conscience and find it necessary first to prepare a deception for themselves in order to be able to command, as if they, too, were only obeying orders. This condition is what, in fact, exists nowadays in Europe. I call it the moral hypocrisy of those in command. They don't know how to protect themselves from their bad conscience, except by behaving as if they were carrying out older or higher orders, from ancestors, the constitution, rights, law, or even God. Or they even borrow herd maxims from the herd way of thinking, for example, as the first servant of their people, or as tools of the common good. On the other hand, the herb man in Europe today makes himself appear as if he is the single kind of human being allowed, and he glorifies those characteristics of his, thanks to which he is tame, good-natured, and useful to the herd, as the really human virtues, as well as public-spiritedness, wishing everyone well, consideration, diligence, moderation, modesty, forbearance, and pity. For those cases, however, where people believe they cannot do without a leader and bellwether, they make attempt after attempt to replace the commander by adding together collections of clever herd people. All the representative constitutional assemblies, for example, have this origin. But for all that, what a blissful relief, what a release from a pressure which is growing unbearable, is the appearance of an absolute commander for these European herd animals. The effect which the appearance of Napoleon made was the most recent major evidence for that. The history of the effect of Napoleon is almost the history of the higher happiness which this entire century derived from its most valuable men and moments. 200. The man from an age of dissolution, which mixes the races altogether, such a man has an inheritance of a multiple ancestry in his body, that is, conflicting, and frequently not merely conflicting, drives and standards of value, which war among themselves and rarely give each other rest. Such a man of late culture and disturbed lights will typically be a weaker man. His most basic demand is that the war which constitutes him should finally end. Happiness seems to him, in accordance with a calming medicine and way of thinking, for example, Epicurean or Christian, principally the happiness of resting, of having no interruptions, of smugness, of the final unity, as the Sabbath of Sabbaths, to use the words of the saintly rhetorician Augustine, who was himself such a man. But if the opposition and war in such a nature work like one more charm or thrill in life, and bring along, in addition to this nature's powerful and irreconcilable drives, also the real mastery and refinement in waging war with itself, and thus transmit and cultivate self-ruling and outwitting of the self, then arise those delightfully amazing and unimaginable people, those enigmatic men predestined for victory and temptation, whose most beautiful expressions are Alcibiades and Caesar. In their company I'd like to place the first European, according to my taste, the Hohenstaufer Frederick II, and among artists perhaps Leonardo da Vinci. They appear precisely in the same ages when that weaker type, with its demands for quiet, steps into the foreground. Both types belong with one another, and arise from the same causes.